Hello and welcome to Running Dialogue, a podcast about movies. We're back from a short break, and we're going to talk about Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And I'll warn you in advance that I'm known to say Billy Pilgrim versus the World from having read Slaughterhouse-Five, so I apologize in advance for that. And we'll talk about The Expendables a little bit, maybe some other things. So I'm Kurt Holman, arts writer for Creative Loafing Newspaper in Atlanta. And with me today are...
Matt Goldberg, managing editor of Collider.com.
And Russ Fisher, senior editor at SlashFilm.com.
Okay. So who wants to jump into Scott Pilgrim? Because I think we all feel strongly about it, mostly positive, but with some misgivings.
I'll do a quick summation, I guess. So Scott Pilgrim is based on a series of six graphic novels by the writer-artist Brian Lee O'Malley. It's been published over the past 6 years, and the sixth and final volume was just published a couple of weeks ago. Specifically timed to coincide with the film, but I think it just managed to work out that things happen that way. So Edgar Wright, who directed Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, directs the film, which stars Michael Cera and kind of a host of secondary actors. Basically, Cera plays Scott Pilgrim, who's an early 20-something sort of nobody kid in Toronto who is dating... not really dating, but has kind of this little romantic thing going on with a 17-year-old high school student named Knives Chow. But he meets Ramona Flowers, who is played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead, and she's quite literally the girl of his dreams. And basically, he to fight the movie is kind of a visualized riff on the idea of dealing with your own romantic history and with the romantic history of somebody else that you get involved with. And so to date Ramona, he has to fight and defeat her previous exes, her seven evil exes, as it were. And the movie is this kind of hyper-stylized pop culture thing that's crammed with music and comic book and video game references. It's probably the best video game movie ever made. It's a hyper-kinetically paced
thing. I would say that even if there were good video game movies ever
exactly.
Before this.
Exactly. And it feels, it's interesting because it takes place in Toronto and it's one of the few movies made not expressly for a Canadian audience that is very much a Toronto movie, which sets it apart because there are all sorts of films shot in Toronto to make the city look like something else, and this very much embraces the city, which is an interesting thing. And so, yeah, it's this long sort of weird, romantic... comic book, video game, samurai action movie thing. And I guess the some of the TV spots I've seen have said that, it's kind of like a movie musical, but instead of dancing, people fight.
Yeah.
And that's a really, really good way to sum up what Scott Pilgrim is.
When I was writing my review, I was thinking, if, Shaun of the Dead was the rom-zom-com, the zombie romantic comedy, this is like the gamer rock rom comic-com almost. Because it touches on so many different kinds of pop culture. And one thing that you mentioned about the stylishness of it, which is probably a big part of it, it's like it's not just stylish during the fighting scenes. It's stylish right from out of the gate,
And it's for the titles have even rolled, it is stylish. Yeah.
And it's almost like Edgar Wright said, it's these movies Trainspotting and Moulin Rouge are kind of stodgy and dull. I want to shake things up a little bit, So, and I really like kind of the heart of the movie, and I like the action scenes, but it's kind of cluttered and busy, and there's a lot of characters in it.
Yeah.
So at first I was like, this is too much, because it's bam, cut. And there's these little comic book effects, visible sound effects appears and all that, which are all individually all very, very well done. But I was getting really kind of tired of it at an early part. And then when kind of the fight scenes start, they're so well put together and funny and ingenious and kind of crazy, and they don't really make real world logic, but that kind of made everything make sense to me a bit,
None of the movie has real world logic, and I think the idea of approaching it as anything other than sort of the movie musical thing, it's like, so you might have scenes that are supposed to be kind of realistic, and then the characters break into song. Essentially, this entire movie is the characters breaking into song. Yeah, it just happens to be that they're not singing or fighting in most of
the
scenes.
Well, it's like a low hum. They're like humming. For and then comes the big breakout song. But I was wondering, Kurt, had you read the books before seeing the movie?
I had never read the books. So since I know that you're a fan of them, I was going to ask you how you felt about them.
Well, it's interesting hearing what you said, because especially when you're saying, you know, there's all these characters. And as someone who's read the book, I'm like, oh, obviously I recognize everyone. I know where they're coming from and all that. So it's interesting to sort of hear where you're coming from. And I mean, if I took a step back, I'm like, yeah, I can kind of see how you have – these are a lot of characters to digest. But I felt that one of the things I liked about the movie is that each actor does give a distinct personality. It's not just like a one-word description, but you see who that person is. And I think that with a lot of these characters, the actors do a great job of – putting a little spin on them to the point where it's like, oh man, who's the standout performance? And I saw it a second time earlier this week. I saw it previously at Comic-Con. And for me, the standout performance kind of both times is Kieran Culkin, who plays Scott's gay roommate, Wallace Wells. And he's just – he has this acerbic tone to him, but he's not a total dick. He's mostly a dick, but he does have this protective angle to him. And I think the film just handles his character really well, and he does a great job of it. But I think everyone – like Mark Webber has great moments as Stephen Stills, and Allison Pill as Kim Pine. And I think this cast, even though there are a lot of characters, they come together really well.
Yeah, I mean – say that they're like wasted, and there's like it's almost like there's a spreadsheet with the characters, and logistically, you know, he follows them through, and they each have their own little bits, and so. But it's like I kind of wish there had been fewer of them, so the ones that they had get maybe a little bit more of it, because as it is, it's like I kind of want the movie to slow down a little bit. You know what I mean?
So, I've seen the film twice now. When I saw it the first time, I'd read the first four volumes, and I'd read them all a couple of times because I quite like them. And by the time I saw the film again, I'd read the fifth and sixth volumes as well. But I kind of agree with you that it does feel overstuffed, and it's the first act is really goes by at such a breakneck pace. I mean, it's just crammed with stuff, and it's crammed with ideas, and they're fun and they're great. But then it's like, by the end of that, the story is getting going, and I'm already a little bit like I was already kind of overwhelmed by everything that was going on. And for me, the middle of the film sags a little bit, and then it picks up again. And in the end, and the last third for me is really strong and really sharp. And it's not to say that there's any particular thing that's bad. Like, there's no performance that I don't like. I think Kieran Culkin is the conscience of the movie, and he's great at it because he's kind of this, you know, Scott Pilgrim is this character who thinks of himself in a very, you know, like a lot of us do, whose conception of himself is a little bit distanced from reality, which is in part why, you know, his conflicts are visualized through fight scenes and that sort of thing. Whereas Kieran Culkin is much more realistic. He's very matter-of-fact. He's like, well, this is who I am, and this is what I do. But he's very upfront with the people he's doing things with. And whereas you can see that Scott really isn't necessarily as much. And kind of the film is about Scott growing up and learning to face who he is and admit it and deal with it.
There's a funny exchange between the two of them where he tells Kieran Culkin's character tells Michael Cera that, you know, he has to do something difficult and involves like breaking up with someone, and he's like, but it's hard, you know. So and one thing, go ahead.
Well, one of the things I really like about Scott's character is, yes, he is immature, and he does grow throughout the film, but it's like you said, you know, we're all sort of – we like to imagine ourselves better than we are. And I like the idea that, you know, we're the heroes of our own stories. And And I'm not saying that that wasn't what you – you know, that was – you were saying that's bad. But one of the things I like about the films is, you know, you can mature and still be that hero. You don't have to sort of – you know, humility and self-respect doesn't necessarily mean you now have to let this effervescent world that you live in sort of fade away. And I feel that – from the start of the film, it does throw a lot at you. And I feel that energy, though, carries throughout the movie. Mm-hmm. And what stops it from being, I'm going to make up a word, monotonal, stops is that the emotional arc keeps moving throughout the movie. So even though there's a lot of high energy, special effects, a lot of use of graphics, in terms of word graphics, and like you said, old kind of a comic book style, I still feel that the Wright still manages to meld the emotions of the film with those, with his special effects and with the pacing.
I will say that having it so stylish from the beginning kind of makes the fight scenes, and these are actually like, they're not just fight scenes, they're like super-powered fight scenes. Like suddenly they have superpowers now, and they don't have them when they're not fighting, basically. Right. You know, the stylishness sort of makes that justifiable. You know, it kind of is of a piece with the heightened nature of the movie. But like when they're not fighting, and when they're kind of dealing with the relationship stuff and like dealing with, you know, your ex's romantic history and all these other, and like breaking up with people, all that stuff, it's like really kind of, it almost, it's really like practical in a way. It's like these are things mostly for like teenagers and 20 somethings, you know, but like these are relationship things that you have to deal with, and most movies don't engage with them in a way that's as direct as this. So it's honestly, it's like, even though it's got these crazy fight scenes and our fantasies that I love so much, but it's felt a lot more practical and real than a lot of these kind of movies that, like, Michael Cera might be in.
Yeah, it's a feel-good movie about getting dumped.
Because
it is something, you know, we all have to deal with, and I think it's really well represented and visualized to the point where you will understand it going through, but it's not hitting you over the head with it. You'll think about it when you come out of the movie, but throughout you'll just be really enjoying it, watching him, these fantastic fight scenes that feel different. I think the film almost goes to the point of fight scene fatigue.
Yeah.
But it goes right up to the line, and it thankfully doesn't cross it. There's one point where it looks like it will.
Yeah.
And it pulls back.
It's like, there's not going to be another fight scene at this point, is there? And there's a couple of points where they like back, say, no, we're just kind of faking it out.
But I would say you guys have talked about various issues you've had with the beginning of the film, but I don't know if I'm the only one who had a kind of a big issue with the ending itself. And I won't spoil it other than to say it looks like the film is heading towards one ending, and it makes a hard right turn to another one. And the one it was headed to is the one I think would have been much more interesting and the one I would have appreciated more. And the other one, it still works. The ending it hits is still good. It doesn't ruin the film, but it's something where, like, I wanted you to go and this, that this way, is and I think that, you did too.
Is it consistent with the books?
Exists on the ending that exists now that people will see is consistent with the books
for the most part.
Just in terms of the basic beats of what happens, it's close enough.
There's an element to the book that is missing from the movies that, in fact, kind of makes this ending weaker.
Right. I think talking about what's in the movie,
it is similar.
It's similar, and the ending that Matt is referring to, that you kind of see, that you might see coming, that doesn't really happen, was shot. And so we probably will see it on the DVD. And there were a couple of different reasons, as I understand it, that's not the way the movie ends now. And it's not like it's a literally we're talking about the last minute of footage or something. It's right at the end where things
I think it has a heavy thematic value. That's what sort of...
I agree, but I'm good with the ending as it exists now.
And now the film was ruined in the last minute. It's not. It's a good ending.
Right.
I had actually seen the film having read all six books, so I was interested. I knew that the ending wasn't going to necessarily copy the book.
Right.
When I was going in, I didn't know what would happen because the film was shot simultaneously while the book was still being written. And in the editing process and the reshoot process, they did kind of share some new ideas and overlap. But for the most part, and you'll sort of see the divergence, I would say, well, I won't go into that detail, but I will say each is their own thing, and I think that the book does some things better than the movie, and I think the movie does some things better than the book.
The fifth and sixth volumes of the book get into much more emotionally weighty stuff than you think they're going to. It gets and deals with it very well. I mean, Brian Lee O'Malley really nails the landing. He gets these things again, and it's basically the books have a much deeper exploration of the idea of dealing with who you are versus who you think you are, and dealing with your past and other people's past.
And it has the space to do it.
Exactly. You know, and that's simply going to be the case. But I think the movie does a pretty good job of it.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for the performance, specifically the performance of Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
Mm-hmm. Really?
She's fantastic mm-hmm. as Ramona. I think the quieter moments, I think she does some really nice kind of small things that keep the movie anchored when she and Scott are just kind of walking and talking versus mm-hmm. all of the big stuff that goes on around them.
She feels a little too aloof to me, to the point where one of the things I did struggle with this film is why her and Scott are together. I didn't really feel a lot of attraction there. And I think that part of that is the point in the sense of why...
She is aloof. It's 500 Days of Summer all over again.
You can see his attraction to her, but right. not so much her attraction to him.
Right, yeah. exactly. Yeah. There's a nice moment in the first book mm-hmm. that she points out what the X on his arm patches, and he's right. like, obviously, one of us went to Xavier School for Gifted Mutants, and one of us didn't. And it's kind of a cute moment, like, you know, here's something I'm interested in, and here's a thing.
Right.
And I'm not saying, like, and the movie has no small moments. No, it is a movie, and they have... It's a good relationship, but I think it's something that could have been a bit stronger.
Well, you know, it's some of that... Again, that's part of the problem with the movie being mm-hmm. as stuffed as it is with things, because there are scenes where, you know, Scott's in a band, mm-hmm. and there are scenes where he's, you know, his band is playing on stage, and you see Ramona watching him, and you see this real affection in her face mm-hmm. for him, and you see her kind of being like, oh, okay, this guy does have this thing that he does, mm-hmm. and this thing that he's actually... maybe not perfect at, but he's really committed to. Like, Sarah, I really struggle watching actors pretend to be musicians mm-hmm. when they play, because it almost never looks real. Mm-hmm. It never looks right to me, or mm-hmm. very, very rarely does. And Edgar Wright and the people with whom he worked, Nigel Godrich, who produced the soundtrack and did a bunch of the score, and is Radiohead's
producer. The music is amazing, just music's amazing.
Godrich was on set, and he did a lot of coaching of the actors as they played their instruments, and he does a pretty good job. And like Scott, Michael Cera as Scott actually looks like he could be playing music.
Yeah. And he was actually, I think, of Sex Bob-omb, the band,
yeah.
he was the only one that had playing guitar before.
Right, right. But, like, you see him playing, and he's got a lot of energy while he's playing, and mm-hmm. so when Ramona is watching him playing, you can see, like, she's kind of like, oh, yeah, okay, this kid has got something, and that's... But some of that is in the background, and mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's not as forefront as it could be, and I agree with you that we could see more of that. And but I did... I guess what I liked in her specifically was just how she grounded the quieter scenes between them, and she made it feel more like a real movie that kind of has a heart and a core, as opposed to this big flashy special effects laden thing.
Yeah, I just felt I mean, Ramona definitely is supposed to be aloof. I just wanted to see a little bit more variety in her character and her relationship to Scott.
Mm-hmm. One thing I want to mention, just to jump on what Russ said a bit, is how one thing that's with all these other things going on in the movie, it's also a fun little satire of kind of the indie music industry.
Oh,
you know,
sure, yeah.
That's kind of because the band stuff kind of runs all the way through it, and there's like scene, and sometimes it gets into kind of this hyperbolic satire with, like, you know, the after party and being asked backstage by a better band, mm-hmm. and there's these music pecking orders, which then become kind of these other kind of fight scenes. So it gives it this other kind of grounding in reality besides just the romantic comedy stuff, and it's the music's very kind of thrashy and punky.
Yeah.
And so many movies like this, several of which have starred Michael Cera, are kind of more emo-y type music.
Right.
I'm not an expert in the music that the kids watch today. It's like, it's so nice to hear like this, like, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, and not just like these kind of morose singer-songwriter type things.
Well,
I appreciated that so much.
And the songs that Scott's band plays mm-hmm. are not particularly polished. They're not like these great, you know, for our Hollywood movie, we got this mm-hmm. band that's recorded six albums, and they're pretending to be. And, you know,
you had a professional guy. You had Beck doing these songs.
Beck wrote the songs, but he wrote them in a weekend, and they're like all this.
Which is great.
You know, the version. No, that's what I'm saying. It's like the stuff that's used is kind of first drafts, mm-hmm. and it sounds appropriate. Like, the songs sound like a kid's band that practices in their living room and is like hungry and wanting to do something, but they're not. You know, they're not great, and they're not, like, the songs are fun and they're catchy, but they're not, like, brilliant pop songs or anything, and that's what the movie's supposed to be, and it works for it.
Right.
And, you know, you're saying about it being kind of a satire of the music industry in a certain extent, and I see people looking at Scott Pilgrim and calling it a hipster movie and all these things, which, to me, is inaccurate because it's actually making fun of that, you know, cooler than thou approach to things and making fun of that super hipster approach to things. It's like, no, get in and get dirty and do it and all that. And I appreciate it for that. I think it does a good job. And part of that is also having the movie being so grounded in Toronto and et cetera.
Yeah.
I just think the film, one of the reasons I really kind of love it is that it does all these different things. You know, it's in the it's in this indie music thing. It's doing video games. It's doing comic books. And it does them all really, really well.
Yeah.
It understands them and doesn't just sort of be like, hey, wouldn't this be cool? Throws it in there haphazardly and then just lets it rest. It comes together as a world. And it is definitely a hyperactive world that's a lot to take in, but it still all fits together.
Yeah. It's even though I find it a little hyperactive and off-putting, I don't think it's sloppy. I think it's very well put together in that way. It's just the effect is kind of overwhelming during parts. You know?
And I think, you know, that's in part intentional, and I think in part that's also just, you know, I mean, it is a generational movie to some extent. You know, it is a movie that represents a certain demographic, you know, that's fine. That's perfectly okay. It's, you know, it's just like, you know, Eat, Pray, Love represents a certain demographic.
Sure.
And nobody's going to criticize it for that or any of these things, you know. And Scott Pilgrim is is very representative of a certain audience. And I think it is extremely representative and probably far more accurately so than any other movie that somebody has tried to make that captures, hey, this is what a certain age group is doing and thinking and how pop culture has influenced them and wormed its way into their lives. And there's a lot of stuff in it that's accurate and that works for me.
Just one thing I did want to touch on is sort of Michael Cera's performance. Because one of the things I've really heard a lot from people who haven't seen the movie or even just through the whole production is like, I don't see Cera as Scott Pilgrim. And it's something I understand because Cera has a kind of mannerism he's known for. It's almost kind of like Bob Newhart-esque. He can sort of – he trails off and he mutters and he sort of has – sometimes he has sort of like a false sunny disposition where he's trying to make, you know, things all right, but you can see he's really shy inside. And that works. I mean, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but I can understand how some people are like, he plays the same character in every movie.
Yeah. And then I heard that a lot before.
Yeah, and I tried to point that out, like, you should see Youth and Revolt. He plays two characters, only one of them.
That's exactly what I've seen in every movie.
For Scott, I think there's a little bit of a curve. Some points he does feel very Sarah, but other points he definitely gets into that effervescent character you see in the books and energy. And I think you will see a different Michael Cera than you've seen previously in any other movie.
And I thought he looked good in the fight scenes, you know?
Oh, yeah. Everyone looks good.
I was going to say that. He's like, who would think that, you know, Michael Cera would be a persuasive action hero,
right.
You know?
And there's, you know, he and Jason Schwartzman plays sort of the big bad guy in the movie, and he looked good in the fight scenes as well. And there's a lot that's been said about them. You know, they did a couple months of training, and they claim that they did most of their own stunts, and that may or may not be true. There's certainly a lot of quick cutting and lens flare in the movie that would be very useful to disguise transition from stuntman to actor. But regardless, both of those guys are in motion a lot through the film and they look good. And then you've got, you know, guys like Chris Evans and Brandon Routh, both of whom play a couple, you know, each of whom plays an evil ex. And
the past Superman and a future Captain America.
Exactly. And they're both great. They're both, you know, they're fun. They do a really good job. They have distinct, interesting kind of personalities that stand out. And each of their scenes is a little, you know, has its own kind of quirks and things.
I think every ex has their own personality except for kind of the Katanagi twins because they just don't really have they're sort of this Japanese mixed group.
They're sort of like, we've got to get 5 and 6 out of the way because movie's long enough, so
exactly.
We need to get to 7.
But
you know.
Yeah. I think, you know, you do have like those buff superhero guys, but then I think, I hope I don't pronounce his name too badly, Satya Baba plays Ramona's first evil ex. He's the one that has to introduce you to all this fight things, and he is so good.
He's so funny. Nails it. He might be my favorite performer in the movie.
And then Mae Whitman, who
from Arrested Development.
She plays the fourth evil ex, and she is good too. She has to rattle off some intentionally corny lines of dialogue, and she does it so well. So again, I think this whole cast really comes together in a great way.
And I will say, the last thing I want to say about it is a lot of like romances where like couples meet and they're getting together, it's like it kind of has to build with one character just to say, well, I love you, and then that solves everything and the movie right. can end, you know. And this, and I'm saying, I won't say that this movie doesn't include that, but it kind of says that it's like there might be things more important than just that.
Right.
And that, and some of those, like, personal integrity is, like, very important, too. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I've seen many movies that'll, like, come out and say, this is as important as these other things. So right. I really appreciated yeah. that, too. Yeah.
Someone isn't supposed to complete you. That's right. that's a re- that kind can be a recipe for sadness.
Yeah, that's a good, that's a very well phrased there. So.
So. Do we want to...
Do
there are two
to
other films opening this yeah. weekend.
Well, it's funny. Last night in Atlanta, there were competing screenings of Eat, Pray, Love with Julia Roberts and The Expendables with everybody else who's a man, you know. I opted to see Eat, Pray, Love, and Matt and Russ opted to see the other one. And later in a kind of an auxiliary shorter podcast, a sidebar podcast, Besher Odell and I will talk about Eat, Pray, Love. But would you guys like to talk about The Expendables a bit, you know?
Yeah, sure. Why not? You know, it's Sylvester Stallone co-writing and directing and mm-hmm. acting in sort of this throwback action movie that mm-hmm. combines the efforts of such action film luminaries mm-hmm. as Jason Statham, Jet Li, Steve Austin, Randy Couture, a couple of these guys who aren't actually action film luminaries, mm-hmm. but you get the point. You know, cameos by Bruce Willis and Arnold Schwarzenegger, Mickey Rourke's in the movie, Eric Roberts, mm-hmm.
Terry Crews,
exactly. And it's this kind of you know, almost a men on a mission movie where you know, these guys are kind of mercenaries and they're hired to get rid of this dictator on an island somewhere. And things go wrong and they basically blow it all up. and it's, you know, it's kind of like...
They are called the Expendables.
That's
so,
right,
yeah.
Exactly. Not enough of them are expendable, I think. Although Dolph Lundgren comes close and he's probably my favorite part of the movie. You know, it's I come to this movie having seen Stallone's Rambo, which, against all odds, I really loved because it's 80 minutes of people exploding.
Rambo or First Blood?
Rambo.
Okay.
Rambo, the fourth movie.
Rambo.
Okay, yeah. Of course, I've seen the other. I mean, First Blood, I think, is a genuinely good movie.
I like First Blood
as, like, a post-Vietnam,
right.
a PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder mm-hmm. movie, is actually way better than most people give it credit for as an early example of, like, kind of where... It's sort of an interesting midpoint between the action films of the 60s and 70s and then what they became in the 80s. And it's like, it's a legitimately good
movie. Oh, absolutely.
You know, but the fourth film in the series, Rambo, is just absurd. It's just ridiculous. It's literally Sylvester Stallone goes to Burma and kills Burma.
Yeah.
That's,
yes.
you know, and it's like, you know what? If you're going to make this movie, then yeah, do that. Mm. And he does. The Expendables.
It feels like Rambo and Pals, which is already sort of contrary to Rambo himself.
Yeah.
Right.
But even then, it's just not it has none of the fun of Rambo. Rambo is right. like, yeah, Rambo's kind of sad and, you know, has a lot of guilt, and then he just kills everyone.
Yeah.
The Expendables is so sad. It's, like, so sorrowful. And I'm like, you have, like, five really buff dudes who are really good at killing people, and you're all about, like, I need to find salvation and redemption, and I need to go and back to this island nation to save this one girl I met this one time briefly on a fake mission that I decided not to do. It's I just thought the film is such a chore, and it shouldn't be. I mean, it doesn't need to have an overcomplicated plot, and it isn't an overly complicated plot.
It's very simple.
But for a man on a mission movie, the second act drops out most of the men who are supposed to be on the mission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're just kind of gone. And, I mean, there are moments that are fun, most of which belong to Terry Crews, and a couple of which belong to Dolph Lundgren.
Right.
You know, the thing is, I really felt there was a Tarantino influence on this movie in the sense that, not in a positive way, just in the sense that, like, okay, there's action, but then the downbeats are like Sylvester Stallone and Jason Statham talking about life and relationships, and who gives a shit?
No chemistry.
Yeah. And they have no chemistry, and there's no, like...
I want to hear about Jason Statham's ideas.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I don't care. I really don't. Or, like, there's this scene with Stallone and Mickey Rourke, and it's more like a competition of who's kind of... Like, Mickey Rourke looks like somehow, like, he, like old Mickey Rourke and Lil Wayne got in David Cronenberg to fly telepods together and emerged out of one as this creature that's in the Expendables. Yeah. I mean, I hate to be that guy who looks at a movie and like rags on somebody's appearance because it's like, you know, there's certain things you just can't change and can't deal with, and it's rude to do so. But Jesus Christ, Mickey Rourke scares me in this movie. Yeah. You know, and he was. It seems like he very obviously came to this movie from the set of Iron Man 2 because he's basically in the same hair and makeup and all of it.
All that's missing is the bird.
Exactly, yeah.
And I think he's painting a bird at one time.
He is, yeah.
Something like that.
But it's like, you know, it felt like Stallone was trying to do this thing where, you know, again, yeah, this big action stuff, but then, like, you know, it's like this is supposed to be his Inglourious Bastards or something, and it just doesn't fly in that respect. There are things I enjoy. There are a few fight scenes that are pretty good. There are a few fight scenes that actually feel kind of bone crushing and pummeling in an appropriate way. And like, you know, when Stallone and Steve Austin fight, it's kind of like, okay, but it's also very quickly shot and quick cut. And, you know, it feels very assembled. And
I don't think the full action scenes are very good. I think they're good action beats.
Yeah.
But you get through the full scene and it's like, okay, and another dude got his neck snapped. And another dude got stabbed a lot, and another dude got shot a lot.
Well, that's what those movies
always
were.
But like, I mean, when you're doing that for like 20 minutes on end, it's like, what else have you got for me? I would say, you know, do that as like background, but show me a few really clever. I don't think there are any really clever kills in the Expendables.
Or very few.
It's a gory film, and again, I think that there are some moments in the action, especially with Terry Crews, who just gets some of the best moments. But for the most part, it feels like, hey, this character is defined by this one fighting thing they do.
Right.
I'm going to let them do it again and again and again.
Yeah.
Whereas I would like to see some variety. And I think Statham kind of has that with his – he's like the knife guy and Jet Li is like the – martial arts Chinese.
The short guy. As well. There are all these jokes about him being small. Mm. And yeah, I mean, you've got Jet Li, but you give him kind of – only really this one big fight, and it doesn't look all that good. And it's, and I mean, the repetitiveness of what each character does is really accurate, I think. And in that respect, it felt very video gamey in the bad sense. You know, it felt like
punch, 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 punch.
Yeah.
Uppercut.
Or just like, you know, it's like, yes, shoot, 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 destroy, things blow up, you change to a different character, do the same thing again. And where, you know, where Scott Pilgrim kind of gets the spirit of video games and the anarchy and the sort of free-flowing jumping from one idea to the next, this just kind of has the repetitiveness and
the grind
and none of the ideas, and it's unfortunate.
Who would think that Michael Cera and Jason Schwartzman would be better as like action fighting guys than the cast of the Expendables?
And yet they are, you know, and their fight scenes, I mean, Edgar Wright stages the fight scenes in Scott Pilgrim with so much more finesse and commitment to them and really investment and interest in what's going on screen, whereas these just feel like, okay, we've got 2 more days to shoot this.
Right.
We need to move on.
Exactly. And what's weird is Rambo is kind of filmed as the same. It's the same kind. Stallone directed both. Mm-hmm. They're both very low-budget films. And I'm just surprised that Rambo works so well. And this one, which, again, Rambo and Pals wouldn't be the worst idea ever. You know, man on a mission movie, bunch of tough guys. It's not a bad idea in concept, but the execution is just awful.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rambo is the, you know, again, the fourth Rambo film is just this grand guignol sort of, like, it's so much. It goes so over the top and so far that either you're completely horrified by it or you can't help but love it because it just, again, it commits.
It's I'm
just
in the latter group.
This is what we're going to do. Yeah. We're going to kill everyone in a country.
We'll see people bisected with a giant machine gun.
Exactly. Yeah. And The Expendables just doesn't go that far, and consequently it feels a lot more limp and a lot more weak because it's just sort of like, yeah, okay, it's here. And it's, you know, it feels like a movie you would have caught on cable in 1988. And, you know,
and I think it wants to be like, that's supposed to be part of its appeal.
Sure.
But there's a movie I could have caught on cable in 1988 had I been older. And I would have liked that movie more. What this film is feels like an imitation and a poor one at that. And again, it doesn't really make sense because it's not like the loftiest goal ever. And
yeah, I mean,
the hardest one to pull off, and yet it still fails.
Yeah.
It's I don't know. I mean, I didn't hate it. I thought it was fine. I was a little You know, I could have done without some of the dialogue and attempts at character stuff. But, you know, it's easy to overanalyze this. It's like, it's just the Expendables. Yeah. It's just a bunch of big guys beating the crap mm-hmm. out of each other. And but, you know, in that respect, it's still just kind of middle of the road and at best.
Mm-hmm. Well, should we do our some video picks now then?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. I have two that I wanted to mention. One, I'll briefly mention Woody Allen's Manhattan, which I bring up because of Scott Pilgrim versus the World, because the plots of both films are oddly similar, because in Manhattan, Woody Allen's dating a high school girl played by Muriel Hemingway, and is kind of self-conscious about the fact that she's so much younger than him, although in Scott Pilgrim, they're like 5 years apart. It's considerably different, you know, in Manhattan. It's from, I believe, 1979 around then. And kind of, you know, pursues this older woman played by Diane Keaton, who has more baggage. And I won't belabor the similarity, because it kind of doesn't go that far, but one film, they're kind of almost like, you know, Scott Pilgrim is like this generation's Manhattan, only with, you know, punk music instead of like Gershwin music and things like that.
But both movies have people exploding into coins.
Exactly. Both movies have there's that. A wonderful part when Wallace Shawn explodes into a coins and And but the other one is Batman Under the Red Hood, which is the a DC and Warner Brothers' original straight-to-video animated film about, obviously, about Batman. And it's the latest in these, like, series of straight-to-DVD films that, animated films that they're doing. And it's certainly the most intense one, and it's one of the best. I kind of enjoy following the series a lot. And it involves Batman, who's voiced by, what's his name?
Bruce Greenwood.
Bruce Greenwood, yeah, who does a nice job. And this mysterious figure known as the Red Hood starts kind of both attacking Gotham's underworld and kind of taking over Gotham's underworld. And he has history that connects him to the Joker, because the Joker, as the film explains, was originally a petty thief called the Red Hood, who had this red helmet, who fell into the chemical vat and came out looking like a Joker from a playing card and went crazy, et cetera, et cetera.
One of the Joker's many origins.
Yeah, exactly. The Joker is in this, voiced by
John DiMaggio.
John DiMaggio from Futurama. So it's the guy who does Bender, but he does actually a very creepy version of the Joker, who's more, I found, a lot more menicing than, like, Mark Hamill's version of the Joker.
Okay, we're done here.
Yeah.
I love Mark Hamill.
He is
the distinctive.
I love Mark Hamill, too, but I find John DiMaggio more scary than his.
I don't want to interrupt.
Well, that's okay, because you obviously saw it too, and feel free to disagree. Mark Hamill, though, is very bright and kind of has the showmanship, and both how the character's written in this and how it's played is a lot more of the kind of anarchic, every punchline is me killing you kind of approach. So, you know. But you go ahead and feel.
It just feels very thuggish. In mm-hmm. fact, like, DiMaggio also voices the character Marcus Fenix in Gears of War. Is that the character's mm-hmm. name?
Yeah.
And I just hear that voice, the sort of grizzled. Mm-hmm. And he just makes the Joker seem like a thug. Mm-hmm. Whereas what I really like about Hamill's performance is that it is very light and things mm-hmm. until it isn't. And then when he gets dark, you really feel that punch. Mm-hmm. Whereas with DiMaggio, I'm like, even the laughter just feels mm-hmm. kind of, oh, and now my character laughs because he's the Joker.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's fine. But it sort of builds with, like, Batman trying to solve this mystery, and characters like Nightwing, who was formerly Robin, and Ra's al Ghul appear in it. And it kind of helps to know some of, you know, the comic book lore of the characters to follow it. But it's very dark and intense and seems very influenced by The Dark Knight. And a lot of these films are rated PG-13 in what seems like a marketing kind of way to appeal to, like, you know, non-kids, and they'll have, like, a couple of minor swears in there to ensure the rating, and this one needs to be PG-13 because it goes some real dark, intense places, and I was pretty impressed by it, so.
No, I mean, it's a good movie for sure, but I steadfastly always defend Mark Hamill as the voice of the Joker. I can't hear anything.
Yeah, I have nothing. To me, it's like, you know, I like this interpretation for this film, and like Mark Hamill's, and, you know, 90% of the other.
And you've seen Batman the Animated Series?
Oh yeah, I've seen all of it.
Right. So,
you know.
So how would you say that's compares to? Because I think that's sort of, in my opinion, Batman the Animated Series is the best interpretation of Batman.
Oh, I'm fine with it. I mean,
comics.
This is just more, you know, like I said, it's going to that kind of Dark Knight level of intensity, while the Batman Animated Series is kind of in this neat gray zone between a lot of, like, the comic books and almost kind of like the original, like, 1940s serials and things like that.
Right.
So, and that kind of art, it's got kind of an art deco.
And it also has its limits from being like a, you know, afternoon cartoon show.
Yeah.
That, the PG-13 rating is much harder to get. Yeah. Although there are some moments where they got really dark, surprisingly.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, Under the Red Hood, I would definitely say is worth a watch.
Okay, so.
Okay, I'll do a couple of things. First, really quick, the Plaza in Atlanta is showing Alien this weekend.
Tell me about this movie.
Yes, exactly. I'm not going to go into too much detail because it's bloody Alien. You've seen it. Actually, I went last night, and I went with at least one of my friends who went had never seen it. And so it was really entertaining to, you know, see somebody seeing Alien for the first time, which is, you know, Alien being one of my favorite movies.
What's wrong with John Hurt? It looks like he's feeling sick.
Exactly. Well, it was funny because my friend had seen Spaceballs, which, of course, riffs on John Hurt's death scene from Alien. And so when that started to come up, she was like, oh, wait, this is where that comes from.
Is he going
to
start singing Hello, My Baby?
Yeah. Exactly. So that was really entertaining. But it's not playing. It's playing Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Mm-hmm. So I think this is going to run on Friday probably. So go down to the Plaza. It's the director's cut. It's a really nice print. So that's worth a look. And then
does it include a scene that wasn't in the original cut that I'll say is during kind of Ridley's chase?
Yes.
Okay, so that's in it.
That's
okay.
The director's cut has a bunch of small little extra things. And then that scene that you're talking about is 2 or 3 minutes, maybe 2 minutes long. And, and that's kind of the one big inclusion back into the director's cut. And then kind of for my actual picks, I want to highlight a guy named Don McKellar, who you see in Scott Pilgrim really, really briefly. Mm-hmm. He's in, like, one shot.
Yeah.
He plays the director of the movie that Chris Evans' character is in Scott Pilgrim. Chris Evans playing an actor named Lucas Lee. And so the director is Don McKellar, who is a writer, director, playwright, actor. Mm-hmm. In Toronto, he's one of the bigger kind of film and entertainment scene guys in Toronto. You might have seen him. He's been in like a couple of Adam Egoyan's movies, like Exotica and The Adjuster. He's in David Cronenberg's movie Existenz. Mm-hmm. He wrote 32 short films about Glenn Gould, and he was in
and directed a film called Last Night, which was a neat millennial movie.
That's the movie. Unfortunately, Last Night is out of print, so you can't get it on Netflix. But maybe you can find it at an actual video store, assuming that any exist. If you have an old school one kicking around. Like in Atlanta, Videodrome and Movies Worth Seeing probably both still have copies of it. But yeah, it is this really made a couple of years prior to the whole, you know, millennial, not really panic, but anticipation. I think it's from 98, but it's a great little movie. And McKellar is one of my favorite actors. He co-wrote, I guess, and starred in a TV series called Twitch City, which has sort of thematic and tonal similarities to Spaced, which is the TV series that Edgar Wright made his name with, and you can get Twitch City on DVD. So really, I would just say kind of pull up Don McKellar's name on IMDb or Netflix and grab a couple of things off there because he's a great actor and a good writer.
He has a recurring role on a Canadian series called Slings and Arrows. It's about a theater company, and he's this like kind of pompous ass basically, and is very funny. And the show is a really wonderful show, so you know that's worth seeing too.
Yeah. Okay, I'll finish it up with a movie about young guy fighting. I just saw it this weekend for the first time. 3 o'clock High. And
that's a super fun movie.
It is a fun movie. I had never seen it before. It had been recommended heavily, and I really enjoyed it. It's about this young kid who is just having one of those days, wakes up late, has to put his shirt in the microwave just to, because it's wet for some reason. And it's just one of those days, everything's rushed. And there's a new kid at the school, and this new kid has a very bad reputation for knocking
Bobby
out
Revelle.
People. Bobby Revelle. And it's just, he just punches, he's a violent guy, and no one wants to be around him. Of course, Jerry Mitchell, he makes the mistake of touching the Revelle on the arm. Revelle doesn't like being touched. And from that point on, Revelle basically says, we're going to be in the parking lot at 3 p.m. and we're going to fight, which for Jerry means you're going to die. You are going to be mangled in a very bad way. Death Would Be Sweet release. Mm-hmm. And the whole film is about him trying to get out of it and finding different ways to escape his fate. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a standard story, but the way it's shot is so wonderful. It's almost like if Sam Raimi directed, has all these great canted angles and weird cutting that keeps up the pace.
It's like High Noon meets Diary of a Wimpy Kid.
Right? I haven't seen the second one, but yeah, I can understand that comparison. And then when it gets to like the fight scene at the end, it really delivers. It's a great fight scene. And then there are these just little great character actors scattered throughout. You have Mitch Pileggi in there. You have Jeffrey Tambor, and I really enjoyed it. I think it's a good flick, good fighter, good young fighter film.
It's one of those movies that I think a lot of people have probably seen pieces of, or maybe caught on cable at some point or whatever, and might recognize, but never gets talked about that much. I think it's a really, yeah, it's a good little high school movie, and it doesn't have epic ambitions or anything,
no.
But what it does pretty well, and it has a lot of personality. Yeah. It's always been a movie that I liked.
You can catch it on Netflix Watch instantly, which is how I watched it.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Okay, well, that's all for today. So thanks again to the guys. Once again, this is Kurt Holman, and I'm with Creative Loafing, and tweet at Kurt_Holman.
I'm Matt Goldberg. I'm with Collider.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/MattGoldberg, all one word.
If I remember correctly, I'm Russ Fisher, and I'm with SlashFilm.com, and I'm at twitter.com/RussFisher, RussFischer, all one word. Yeah.
And thanks to Alejandro Leal for, again, being our producer and making this happen. And thank you for listening all the way through to the end.